for joining us. I'm Diane Rehm. Last week, GOP presidential candidate Rick Perry called Social Security a Ponzi scheme. Changes to the program will be on the Congressional Debt Super Committee's agenda. And President Obama hopes to ignite the job market in part by extending cuts to payroll taxes that otherwise would go into the trust fund. Joining me here in the studio to look at the future of Social Security, Nancy Altman of the Strengthen Social Security Coalition, and Charles Blahaus, a Hoover Research Fellow and a public trustee for the Social Security and Medicare programs. Joining us from WBEZ in Chicago is Mark Miller. He's a syndicated columnist specializing in retirement issues. Of course, your comments, questions are always an important part of the program. Call us on 800-433-8850. Send us your email to drshow@wamu.org. Join us on Facebook or Twitter. Good morning and welcome to all of you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Mark Thanks, Miller, so. Let me start with you. Governor Perry's views on Social Security seem rather extreme. What is the reality? Can Social Security legitimately be called a Ponzi scheme?
No, I think that was a reckless and irresponsible comment, frankly. You know, the essence of Social Security is that people pay taxes and they accumulate credits, and in return they get a pension, and that's a program that's been working for 75 years, and the essence of a Ponzi scheme, if you check that in the dictionary, is criminal fraud. So Social Security, on the one hand, is backed by a demonstrated legal and political commitment and big financial reserves, and we can get into a discussion, I'm sure we will, about what that's all about. And the other, a Ponzi scheme, is backed by nothing. So it's really a comment, you know, that is very baseless in my view.
And turning to you, Charles Blahaus, you're one of two public trustees of the Social Security Fund. Exactly what are your responsibilities?
Well, the short of it is we're responsible for reporting each spring on the financial condition of Social Security and Medicare, both now and projected into the future. There are two public trustees, one Democrat, one Republican. Your listeners can guess which I am by the end of the program if they're inclined. The other public trustee is Dr. Robert Reischauer, who I'm very privileged to serve with. The public trustee positions were created as part of the 1983 reforms, and they were created because there was a concern on the part of elected officials that the projections be reviewed so that the public could be confident that they weren't being slanted in any particular way. And so these two public trustee positions were created to join the government trustees, the Secretary of Treasury, the Social Security Commissioner, Secretary of Labor, and the Secretary of HHS. And our primary responsibility is just to make sure that the projections are done in the best possible way.
And what are the current projections for the fund?
Well, there's a number of different elements of the projections. The combined Social Security trust funds are projected to be solvent through 2036. And the Social Security trust funds have two pieces. There's a disability piece, and there's an old age and survivors piece, which people think of as the retirement program. The disability piece is in much more dire condition. It is projected to be insolvent by 2018. The retirement piece is projected to be insolvent by 2038.
Why is the disability piece so much more dire?
That's a very good question, and there are a lot of opinions about it. But I think there's really, I'd say, three different pieces. One is that when the tax rates were set, the 12.4% payroll tax the division of that tax into the retirement tax and the disability tax. That was set in the 1983 reforms. And then the disability eligibility rules were liberalized considerably in the 1980s.
I see.
So right off the bat, disability got into more trouble. Now, disability got another shove into trouble with the recent recession. Historically, it's always been the case that when we have a recession, disability claims spike. But even before that happened, the disability program was in worse shape than the retirement program.
Charles Blouhouse, he's a, Hoover Research Fellow, one of two public trustees for the Social Security Medicare programs, author of Social Security, The Unfinished Work. Turning to you, Nancy Altman, how do you think Social Security actually compares with insurance plans or other pension plans?
Social Security is an extremely good deal. It is, as you say, it's insurance. Some people talk about the need to modernize Social Security, but the concept is really thoroughly modern. The idea is that as long as workers are dependent and their families are dependent on wage income, they need insurance against the loss of those wages. They need unemployment insurance if they lose their jobs, disability insurance if they become disabled, life insurance, old age insurance. Social Security provides the last three. Actually, unemployment insurance was part of the 1935 Social Security Act. If you try to compare it to buying life insurance or disability insurance or private pension in the private sector, you really can't find the product. Social Security provides is completely portable, which private pensions generally are not, between from job to job. They are completely protected against inflation. They it has extremely low administrative costs, returning more than 99 cents of every dollar in benefits. It has benefits for divorced spouses in private sector. You'd have to argue about that in divorce court. It has all kinds of advantages that you can't get because it's universal and because it covers insurance works best when it has the largest risk pool. And ours is a risk pool covering the whole nation. And that's why Social Security works so well and is so popular.
Nancy Altman, co-director of Social Security Works. She's author of The Battle for Social Security. And do join us, 800-433-8850. Send us your email to drshow@wamu.org. Mark Miller, I should have mentioned that you are also the author of The Hard Times Guide to Retirement Security. Turning back to you, the Congressional Debt Super Committee is going to consider changes to Social Security, but that's not really part of its mission, is it?
Well, it depends on whether you consider Social Security to be part of the deficit problem or not. I'm one who does not. And, you know, I think that your guests in the studio there are closer to the numbers and the way that the monies are transferred back and forth. But, you know, I would argue that it's not part of the problem. If I could I just offer a quick comment on this notion of insurance?
Certainly.
The broader context of where we are in terms of hard times economy and where people are in terms of retirement security needs to be part of the backdrop of this conversation, which I'm sure is going to get very nuts and bolts and numbers oriented in just a second. I'd just like to point out a couple quick things. One is that we've seen a near complete disappearance of defined benefit pensions in the private sector, which, you know, when we talk about insurance, what we're insuring against is longevity risk with a pension or with Social Security. Longevity risk simply means running out of money before you run out of time. And the fact is, none of us can know how long we live. So, you know, private accounts, while valuable, 401k, IRA, and the like, nobody can really know how much they're going to need. So what's so valuable about insurance of the type that we're talking about is that it does provide income for life. And the statistics show that the very old tend to rely on Social Security for a much higher percent of their total income. And so even people who will say, I'll get comments from readers occasionally to say, well, I've got plenty of money, I won't need Social Security. But even people with a fair amount of assets can exhaust those assets as they get into advanced age. So this is one of the things that's so important. The other thing about this discussion, when we talk about boosting retirement ages, making people work longer, saying, oh, we're all living longer, we should all work longer, more and more people are trying to do that, but it's easier said than done in a, you know, climate with 9%+ unemployment. And the statistics show that most people retire earlier than they thought they would, either due to job loss, disability. In fact, the Employee Benefit Retirement Institute found that this year 45% of Americans are retiring earlier than they thought they would. So we're really up against a crisis in retirement security, and I feel strongly that that's one of the reasons why Social Security is so critical.
Chuck, a crisis in retirement security?
It's funny. I certainly agree. We have very severe challenges in retirement security, but I have some perspectives that are different from the ones we just heard with respect to the role of Social Security and the broader budget issue. I have something of a schizophrenic attitude towards the Joint Committee on the Social Security question. On the one hand, they've been given a charge of producing a certain amount of deficit reduction within 10 years. That's probably not the best way to think about the Social Security problem. The Social Security system is really a long-term program. And if you're just trying to get as much deficit reduction as you can within a 10-year window, that's probably not the best format for thinking carefully about Social Security policy over the long run. On the other hand, there is language tucked into the committee's charge that says they need to make recommendations to deal with the long-term fiscal predicament, and their Social Security clearly does play a very significant role.
All right, short break here. We'll talk further when we come back and take your calls. I look forward to hearing from you. Welcome back. We're talking about Social Security, a subject I believe affects a good many of us. In fact, 90% of all workers are in jobs covered by the program. Here in the studio, Nancy Altman, co-director of Social Security Works, and the author of The Battle for Social Security. Charles Blauhaus is a Hoover Research Fellow, one of two public trustees for the Social Security and Medicare programs. He's author of Social Security, The Unfinished Work, and Mark Miller. He's on the line with us from WBEZ in Chicago. He's a syndicated columnist and author of The Hard Times Guide to Retirement Security. Nancy, you were Alan Greenspan's assistant when he chaired that commission that developed the 1983 amendments to Social Security. What were the most important changes at the time?
Well, let me speak first of all, put it in a context, and then tell you the most important changes. It was quite different from now because there was widespread agreement on the fundamentals of Social Security, so that the members decided right off the bat that they were focused just on Social Security, not on Medicare. They decided they were not focused on the deficit, even though there were concerns about the deficit back then. And they focused and they ruled out major changes like privatizing it or means testing it or something like that. So within that framework, they looked at the income coming in and the outgo.
Right.
At that time, because of the stagflation, there was concern. There was an immediate crisis. Benefits wouldn't have been paid within a matter of about 18 months. So that they focused on that. They did a number of things. They delayed the cost of living by 6 months. They began taxation of benefits, which was a major change at that point. They moved up the FICA rate that was in the law. But they also were concerned about the long term. And for the long term, they didn't reach agreement. They said to Congress, we should make sure the funds are there for the baby boom. Hmm. You can either raise the retirement age or put a rate increase in around 2010. And Congress chose to raise the retirement age. So it is currently at 66, going up to 67 as a result of that 1983 law.
And Chuck, when you say those reforms created confusion over program finances and further gridlock, what do you mean?
Well, I would just second what Nancy said. I think on the first point, which is I think one of the reasons the 83 reforms were possible was that there was a common understanding of the nature of program financing. You could talk to Republicans or Democrats in 1983, and they would both say, we've got a problem, here's the size of it, and here's the size of the shortfall we have to fix. You talk to people on different sides of the aisle today, they don't feel that way at all. And the biggest reason, I think, is because we now have this massive Social Security trust fund sitting there, at least on paper, and that greatly affects people's view of the urgency of the problem or the lack of urgency of the problem. A couple of points I would make about the 83 reforms. A lot of people don't realize that the shortfall we now face today is much, much larger than the one we faced in 83, even in a relative sense. And the reason people don't realize that is that the trustees' methods of measuring the shortfall changed in the interim. They changed in 1988. So if you look at the shortfall today relative to 1983, it's already over 50% larger and getting larger rapidly. And there's no political precedent already for closing a shortfall of the size we now face. The other difference, and I think it's very sobering, is that while in one sense the problem was more urgent in 1983 because the trust fund was almost out of money, there's another sense in which the problem is much, much more urgent today. Back in 1983, the demographics weren't hitting them in the face. There was a pretty stable ratio of workers or collectors. And so if you had a delay of a year or two, you could patch the program over. Things wouldn't get too much worse. The problem wouldn't get too much more difficult to solve. But that's not the case today, because every year we wait, we've got more and more boomers on the rolls, and the gap between the program's outflow and its income is widening very dramatically.
Now, Mark Miller, from your point of view, aren't there pretty simple options to fix the program?
Well, the options that are front and center in the discussions that have come forward from the various commissions, the bipartisan commissions that have looked at solutions, the two that seem to be front and center are another increase in the retirement age. That's a big one, with the underscore on the word another, as Nancy just explained. And the other would be the change in the cost of living formula to something called the chain CPI. And we can get into that if you like. But the net effect of that is a reduction, I believe, about 0.3% annually in cost of living increases for seniors. That one's going to be quite controversial because the cost of living adjustment is one that in that situation already enrages seniors. I can tell you from my mail. So those are the two that are out there that get discussed most often. But the other one that I think should be part of the mix of discussion, I certainly hope will be, is to eliminate the cap on the amount of earnings that are taxed for FICA. If you completely lifted that tax, that eliminates most of the shortfall, according to most of the analysis I've read.
Nancy.
And let me put this in again in context, because we talk about solutions, but it's more maintenance of the program. As Chuck has said, projections are made every year, 75 years down the road. And this is a program that is very fiscally responsible, conservative. As Chuck said, it can pay all benefits in full and on time for the next quarter of a century. And then the shortfall is just 0.6% of gross domestic product. It's about the same as extending the Bush tax cuts for the top 2%. So it's a very manageable size. It's still decades away. The problem is there's not even agreement on the goal. It used to be that traditionally we put it in balance for 75 years and we were done, and that seemed awfully good. Now people talk about an infinite time horizon. They talk about sustainable in the 75th year. They even talk about making sure the money coming in from one source of its revenue, taxes, balances its benefits. That's never been an issue over the last 76 years, and that's part of what's making solutions more difficult.
How would you feel about lifting that cap on income?
I think that is where a very good solution, and one our polling shows that two-thirds of the American people support. There actually is good policy reason for raising it because of the inequality.
It's currently at $106,800.
That's
okay.
Correct.
And you would be in favor of lifting it altogether?
There are many different solutions. What I say and what our coalition says is that benefits are already extremely low. They average about $13,000 a year. Administrative costs are already very low, less than 1%, and really should be a little bit more than is being spent right now. So there's no room on that side. We should be looking for revenues. We can do it through the cap. We can do it through a new source of revenue. We can do it without raising taxes, in part by diversifying the portfolio, which has been proposed too.
And Chuck, how would you respond to the idea of taking that cap off?
I think it's one of those measures that surveys much better than it works. And the reason for that is that in Social Security, benefits and contributions are linked. And the more you pay into the system, the more you get out. It's not designed to be a welfare program. Basically, no matter how rich you are, no matter how poor you are, you get something back for
something.
Your contributions.
Right.
So if you lift the cap, then unless you sever that link between contributions and benefits, then you're going to obligate a very large amount of additional benefit outlays to people who need them least. You're basically bringing in more revenue from rich people to pay more benefits to rich people. Now, you could just sever that link. But that would be a very fundamental, I would argue, radical.
How would you sever that?
You could just say that the benefit base will only go up to the pre-legislated change cap, and you won't get any benefit credits above that. Now, I think that would be a very radical step, and I would recommend against it, because that, to me, destroys what Social Security has always been, which is this idea of an earned benefit.
Would you lift the cap at all?
Let's put it this way. I myself would not advocate raising the cap because, frankly, we can talk about the numbers, but it doesn't do that much for you financially. It does a lot more for you by some accounting measures than by others.
But doesn't it put a lot more into that trust fund?
It puts more revenues in the trust fund, and then you have to obligate additional benefits later on. So a lot of people have suggested, for example, raising the cap on taxable wages so that it covers 90% of all national wages. And that was the historic high point back in 1983.
What would that mean?
Well, it would be the equivalent of about $180,000.
Okay.
Today. So, but that if you did that, the size of your annual shortfalls would only go down. It would go down a little bit, but it would go down by about 14-15%. So it doesn't accomplish as much as it first appears from a trust fund accounting perspective. And this gets to another point I'd like to make, which is that what often happens in the Social Security debate is that advocates of particular policies tend to point to the particular scorekeeping metric
sure.
that makes their proposal look
exactly.
good. But the bottom line is there have been a lot of bipartisan panels and advisory boards that have basically come forward and said, here are the different standards any plan has to meet for financial credibility. And the balance of the trust fund is just one. You can change that by accounting gimmicks. That doesn't by itself fix program finances. So you have to look at a lot more metrics than just whether there's a non-zero balance in the trust fund.
Mark, how do you respond to that idea of lifting the cap on income?
I mean, I think it should be part of the mix. What I've struggling to, as I listen to Mr. Blauhaus, I'm trying to understand what solutions he is for. I know in the past, you know, during your years in the Bush administration, you were for private accounts. I don't know if that's where you're still heading with this. I don't know exactly what you think the fix is.
Well, I'm happy to speak to that. In my book, I actually outline a whole chapter on my preferred ideas. And I think in an ideal world, we would have a funded component to the system, because one of the problems that we have is that a pay-as-you-go financing system is very unstable when the worker-to-collector ratio drops. But even though I did and very happily support a personal account proposal when working for President Bush, we may not be in a position today where something like that is feasible. And I certainly, there are many solutions that I've written favorably about that do not include a personal
account. Such as?
Well, the Simpson-Bowles Commission, for example, it contains a few provisions I don't particularly like. It would raise the cap on taxable wages
right.
over time. It would bring in state and local workers. I don't like either provision. But on balance, it's a reasonably bipartisan approach. They make progressive changes to the benefit formula. They make, in my judgment, a very modest change to the retirement age. And they do a number of other things that make a lot of policy sense. And it would be a reasonable bipartisan compromise. Not my ideal plan, but it would be a reasonable compromise.
Charles Blahouse, he's a Hoover Research Fellow, one of two public trustees for the Social Security and Medicare programs, author of Social Security, The Unfinished Work. And you're listening to The Diane Rehm Show. Nancy Altman, I know you wanted to comment.
Yes. Again, it's important to understand that this is a program that can only pay benefits if it's got the income to cover the costs. It's very conservatively managed. It can pay all benefits for the next 25 years. So we should first look to proposals that have good policy independent of bringing in finances. So, for example, the lifting that cap to 90%, that was Congress's intent, because the idea is this is wage insurance and that most workers need all their wages insured, but the very wealthy don't need them all insured. But even them, they can invest in Bernie Madoff and have a problem. So 90% seemed the right amount. That takes care of a third of the shortfall, and all it requires is one additional week of withholding. You can phase it in over 30 years. Yeah. So they're very modest kinds of revenue improvements that are good policy in and of themselves and can eliminate the long-term projected shortfall.
But, Mark Miller, you talked about the mail you get from seniors.
Right.
How does the public view even the smallest changes to Social Security?
Well, the change in the cost of living adjustment, I think, is interesting in the context of what Nancy just said. She was talking about the fact that changes to Social Security in the past have always been phased in quite gradually. One of the things that with this proposal of changing the COLA, which I believe was one of the Simpson-Bowles ideas and also emerged from a couple of the other commissions and certainly will be considered by the supercommittee.
And we should inject, that there has not been any cost of living adjustment for the past 2 years.
Which has to do with just the way that the current formula is written. And we had a big spike in inflation right before the markets crashed in 2008 that basically pushed ahead the COLAs for the ensuing couple of years. But that's why we didn't have it for the last 2 years. It wasn't a specific policy decision.
Right.
But what I wanted to get to was this idea that if we change the formula again, that is something that would impact current beneficiaries. It's a much more near-term change, and it compounds some of the calculations suggest roughly an 8.5% cut in benefits for somebody that makes it to 92. So it's a more immediate cut, and it'll be a very controversial cut.
And I'm sure you hear from an awful lot of seniors who are worried.
Oh, terrified. And the other Simpson-Bowles idea, this idea of another increase in the retirement age, I think people who support that idea like to say, well, we're all living longer, so we should push out the retirement age. It's important to understand that when you move up what's called the normal retirement age or the full retirement age, that's the time at which you qualify for your full entitled benefits. If every time you move that up, that's an across-the-board benefit cut due to the formulas and the ways that benefits are calculated. So it just means you've raised the bar. If the retirement age is 66 and you work to 66, you get your full benefit. If the retirement age is now 67 and you work to 66, you get 67 minus you get dinged for a year's penalty on that is the very short form. And Nancy or Mr. Blaus, I'm sure, could give more detail on that. But so it's important to understand it's a benefit cut at a time when people are struggling.
Chuck.
Well, I feel it's important to give a very different perspective on this whole retirement age question. Remember, when this program was first established by FDR, you couldn't collect benefits till 65. Now, there's a lot of things, as Mark said, that go to determine the benefits you can get at a particular age. There's the early eligibility option age, which is now 62. There's the normal retirement age, and there's the benefit formula. And all those things work together to determine the benefits you can get at a particular age. Now, since the program was first established, we established early eligibility at 62, quickly became the most popular age of claim, and we also increased benefits several times. Even if we were to raise the early eligibility age and the normal retirement age by 3 years each, people would still be able to retire at an earlier age and get a much bigger relative benefit than they originally could. So we need to be a little realistic about what's financially possible.
So it's clearly all very complicated. When we come back from a short break, we'll open the phones for your comments, your questions. I look forward to hearing from you.
National broadcast of The Diane Rehm Show is made possible in part by American University, dedicated to educating wonks to use knowledge to change the world. More at american.edu/wonk. By the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, dedicated to the idea that all people deserve the chance to live healthy, productive lives at gatesfoundation.org. And by the Wallace Foundation, a source of ideas for expanding learning opportunities beyond the school day at wallacefoundation.org. This is NPR.
Concussions are on the rise in the U.S. and not just among athletes. The science and symptoms of brain injuries and why they're often undetected. The Diane Rehm Show. Next hour. And it's time to open the phones as we talk about the difficulties, the problems, the solutions that could face Social Security. Let's go first to Cape Cod, Massachusetts. Good morning, John. You're on the air.
Diane, it's a wonderful show and very timely, as usual.
Thank you.
My question is for the panel, do they have any comments on the fact of the apparent fact that the federal government owes the Social Security Trust Fund $15 trillion, that's with a T, trillion dollars?
Where did that figure come from, Charles Blaus?
I can't say where $15 trillion came from. The current balance in the trust fund is between $2.6 and $2.7 trillion.
Now, how much does the federal government owe the trust fund? It is said it's been borrowed from expensively.
Where that, I think, $15 trillion comes from is that the total public debt, the total amount owed, the debt limit that just had to be raised in August was $14.3 trillion. About 10% of that is owed to the OPEC nations, some to China, some to private pension plans, and about as Chuck says, $2.6 trillion, or about 20% of that, is owed to the Social Security trust funds.
20% of
$2.6 trillion.
Okay, so does that make you feel a little better, John?
Well, it does, but I got this from Wikipedia. Of course, I know Wikipedia has its problems, so maybe their figure is wrong, but they opposed this debt in the form of special treasury bonds that they have held, which are, of course, under the full faith and honor of the United States of America.
Mark Miller.
Yeah, you know, this is a really important point that I'm hoping the three of us could all agree on. I mean, the trustees' report, which Chuck signs, says that by law these are assets that are invested in interest-bearing securities backed by the full faith and credit of the government. The reason I wanted to bring this up is that we do hear talk from time to time that, oh, there's nothing there. It's a bunch of IOUs. President Bush famously visited the facility where the bonds are stored and said, there's nothing there. It's just a bunch of paper IOUs. And this is something that I think causes a lot of confusion, this point that somehow the government raided the fund. I mean, when you build up a $2 trillion surplus, you don't keep that in cash in the piggy bank. And so it's been invested in treasuries, we think the most secure form of investment in the world. And so, but it gets portrayed as some kind of irresponsible maneuver. And yes, it's a transfer back and forth between two units of government, but I don't see where the problem lies there. But we hear all the time that there is no such thing as a trust fund. Literally, you hear people say that.
Well, I'm glad we could clear up that point for John and all our listeners. To Alan, who's in Ann Arbor, Michigan, good morning. You're on the air. Alan, are you?
Hello. Oh, yes. Here I am.
Go right ahead, sir.
Thank you. An excellent, timely program, of course.
Thank you.
I have a perspective of some history I could offer. My father was one of the drafters of the Social Security Act. And the history of this, coming from Governor Robert La Follette, a progressive in Wisconsin, is that this was progressive legislation. And La Follette called the chairman of the economics department of the University of Wisconsin in 1923 or so to say to John R. Comm, John, would you get your graduate students on this question? I want Social Security for everyone in Wisconsin. Get me some legislation by the end of the semester or something to that effect. And my father and others were in that graduate class and assistants to it, and they drafted the first Social Security Act. Huh. When Roosevelt was persuaded by his woman Secretary of Labor, Frances Perkins, to do for America what La Follette had done for Wisconsin, he called the same group, now all professional economists, from the University of Wisconsin to do for America what they had done for Wisconsin. So this was progressive legislation from the beginning. And I was also privileged in 1985 to be at my father's house in Ann Arbor, where they had a gathering of the survivors who had done this work and had been with the Social Security Commission for their professional lives. And I, myself, somewhat as a more change-the-system radical, was very impressed by the satisfaction this group of people had of actually producing a piece of progressive legislation, reform from within, that sustained itself and was sustainable.
Alan, I so appreciate your historical perspective.
And I've got to say, I was privileged to know Wilbur Cohen, who is a protege of Professor Commons, who worked for Governor La Follette, who was involved in the 1983 legislation, as were two other men who started working on that program in the 1930s. We have their legacy, and part of what I'm trying to do is pass their legacy on, because they've really done so much for this country.
Chuck.
And Diane, sorry.
Go ahead, Mark.
I was just going to add quickly that, A, you know, to me it's one of the most remarkable policy achievements of our country, but second, to just quickly add that at the time that the act was passed, half of the population over age 65 was living in poverty. And I forget what the rate is now, but it's maybe 15%. So it's been a remarkable achievement.
I just think it's important to bear in mind that when we talk about repairing Social Security's finances going forward, we're really not talking about undoing FDR's legacy. The program that FDR established and was established in the original Social Security amendments, if we'd left it in that form, it would be perfectly financially sustainable today. The trouble the program got into was a result of many amendments over the years afterwards. In particular, in the 1970s, there was a very substantial overreach in terms of benefit promises in 1972. There was a 20% across-the-board increase in benefits. They established an accidentally doubly indexed benefit formula that had to be phased out in the late 70s to early 80s, creating the so-called notch babies because this formula had been erroneously put down. And the shortfalls that we now face are a direct product of the legislative changes made in the 1970s, not the ones made by FDR.
I think Nancy has something to say about that.
I disagree. President Roosevelt said at the time that this was supposed to be a cornerstone. He started out in 1935 with retirement, added survivor benefits in 1939, disability was added in 1956, Medicare was added in 1965. And all of this is perfectly affordable. Medicare has health care issues, but the rest is completely affordable. The increases that have come were understood, as I said. One of the actuaries who worked there in 1934 also worked on the 1983 amendments.
Interesting. Mark.
Well, wasn't the 20% increase in the 70s, if I recall correctly, and I'm happy to be corrected, before we had the automatic cost of living increase, and it was an attempt to catch up with inflation?
That's exactly right.
And the response to that was legislation that put in place the automatic cost of living adjustment.
They were putting as part of the same legislation.
It was the same legislation.
Part of the 72
same amendments. Legislation.
But it was catch up and then indexing from that point forward.
Because we didn't have callers at that time.
No.
All right. Let's go to Rockford, Illinois. Good morning, Roger.
Good morning, Diane. Good morning to your guests. I have two questions. The first one is one of the major features of the Paul Ryan budget thing was to lean very heavily on private investments rather than Social Security as a way to form retirement. And based on what's happened with the stock market over the last decade even, it seems to me that doing that would put retirees at severe risk for not really even having retirement points. The second one is the disability section that your guest mentioned earlier. I understand that it can be in trouble because of the increased amount. What I don't understand is that when people put in legitimate claims, I mean medically documented and everything else, it takes 5 to 7 years to get it approved. So I'd like to hear the response to those two questions.
All right.
Thank you.
Thank you. And first to you, Chuck, on that private investment versus Social Security.
Yeah, and I would stress, I'm not here to flog the issue of personal accounts, but I think it's important to bear in mind that there's risk in all these types of systems. I think there's a great misperception that somehow we shield beneficiaries from risk by having the virtue of a defined benefit system. All of our defined benefit systems throughout the country have enormous problems, and they have enormous problems for the same reasons. There's a big moral hazard associated with them, where you have a situation where the person who's responsible for funding the benefit has every incentive to try to do it at least possible cost to themselves. And so this is why the employer-provided defined benefit pension system gets in trouble. It's why the state and local systems have gotten into trouble. And it's why Social Security is in trouble.
Nancy.
It's very important to understand that Social Security is insurance. Private accounts are savings. Savings are fine on top of insurance. But we need this basic insurance. When you think what's happened to 401ks, to home equity, we need this fundamental foundation of protection, and that's what Social Security provides. It's the most sound part of our retirement income system, so we should keep it strong, and in fact, I think even expand it.
And didn't you say that Social Security funds are invested in U.S. Treasuries, and therefore, unlike private the investment programs, which would not all be invested in U.S. Treasuries?
Well, a couple of things. One, it's very important to distinguish between what you're invested in and whether you have a funded system or not. You could have the current Social Security system and invest the trust fund in the stock market. And some people, I oppose that, but some people have proposed doing that. President Clinton proposed doing that. You could also have a personal account system that was invested entirely in treasuries. So we shouldn't confuse the issue of what the money's invested in with whether or not we have a savings-based system.
Go ahead, Mark. I didn't mean to interrupt. It's difficult from the remote.
Yeah.
You know, I just wanted to, because I write quite a bit about 401ks and IRAs. That's the component of private investment and saving for retirement that we have now. And I just want to comment quickly to say that these don't come close to replacing defined benefit pensions in value. A recent survey, the Transamerica Retirement Center, found that only 30% of American workers have saved over $100,000 in these accounts, although I want to say that the percentages are a bit higher with workers closer to retirement. But that's clearly, you know, indicates that that system is not getting us there. And that we need defined benefits in the mix to going back to this point of longevity risk. And there's a whole variety of reasons why they don't work. The average retirement investor is not equipped to make the best decisions about investment. They too often don't pay close attention to what's going on. And then finally, with the loss of jobs, that interrupts the contribution levels, the depression, the decline in wages that we've seen over the last 20 years means people have less to invest and so on. So, I mean, we could spend hours on that, but just to say that it's not getting us there.
Mark Miller, and you're listening to the Diane Rehm Show. Nancy, I know you wanted to add to that, but please also respond to the question about why it takes 5 to 7 years to get disability.
That is an excellent point. The just to add to and amplify what Mark said, and then I'll turn to the disability. A fundamental difference is with individual accounts, the risk is all borne by the individual. If the stock market's down or your investments are down, you're in trouble if you have to retire. With Social Security and generally with defined benefit plans, the risk is shared by everyone. With Social Security, it's shared by the entire nation. That's what makes it work so well. With respect to disability, it is really outrageous that there is such a long lag time. Why is it? Because even though the administrative costs for Social Security are paid from workers' contributions, we've got $2.6 trillion in trust assets, but the Congress has been cutting the budget of the Social Security Administration, even though the money's there. And they've been trying desperately to cut back that backlog, and they've succeeded. But Congress, as part of this new budget cutting, has cut the budget more.
All right. And now, in the short amount of time we have left, I'd like to ask each of you how, if you had the authority, how you would fix, or if you would fix, how you would fix Social Security. I'll start with you, Mark.
I would do it by lifting and eliminating the cap on income subject to tax. That's how I do it.
And that's it?
That's it.
That's the only change you would make.
I'm not in favor of higher retirement ages or changes of the COLA.
And how far would you lift that cap,
or
would
I'd be in favor of eliminating it.
Eliminating it. Okay. To you, Nancy.
Eliminating it is certainly preferable to raising the retirement age or cutting the benefits, which are extremely modest. Other possibilities that I think would be perfectly acceptable, a new progressive source of revenue. Some have talked about dedicating a tax on stock speculation, a kind of tax that Great Britain has. Dedicate that to Social Security. You actually could raise the benefits. That's how much money is brought in. There are other kinds. Some have talked about dedicating the estate tax. There are a variety of options that are available, all of which I think would be very popular. The American people are united about this. If policymakers listened to the American people across the spectrum, we could solve this without the kind of political friction that we have.
Chuck.
Well, Well, I'll quickly gloss over two things that I would support, that a lot of people support. I would make progressive changes to restrain the growth of benefits, still above inflation, but restrain the growth to people on the higher income end. And I would, unlike my colleagues, raise the retirement age, at least to get it back to where we were when the program first began.
To what?
To 65, at least, the earliest eligibility age.
Earliest eligibility.
And I'd be willing to go faster, even if the political system wouldn't. But there's a set of changes that I would make that hasn't been talked about enough, which is that we should change the benefit formula so that we improve the or get rid of some terrible work disincentives in the current system. Under the current system, the longer you work, the worse your returns. I would change the benefit formula so that you got your benefit in proportion to each year that you work, and that would actually produce some savings over time.
And that's it.
Those are the main things I would do. Together,
all
you
right.
can get to solvency.
You've heard it here. Let's hope that what happens in the next few months does bring some real change and some real benefit. Thank you all, Nancy Altman, Charles Blahaus, Mark Miller. Thanks for listening. I'm Diane Rehm.
The Diane Rehm Show is produced by Sandra Pinkard, Nancy Robertson, Susan Neighbors, Denise Couture, Monique Nazareth, Sarah Ashworth, Lisa Dunn, and Nikki Jex. The engineer is Toby Schreiner. AC Valdez answers the phones. Visit drshow.org for audio archives, transcripts, podcasts, and CD sales. Call 202-885-1200 for more information. Our email address is drshow@wamu.org, and we're on Facebook and Twitter. This program comes to you from American University in Washington. This is NPR.